Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're watching and listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, my very special guest is Brett Oldham. And Brett has been with us in the past. He's recently written a new edition for his classic book, Children of the Greys. It's called Children of the Greys Aftermath. And I'm really looking forward to having Brett back on the show to talk about any recent revelations or epiphanies that he's had since the release of the first edition. So, without any further ado, Brett, welcome back to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
Thank you, James. I appreciate you having me back. It's been a while, but always good to talk to you.
Absolutely. Now, take us back to the first edition of your book. Just as kind of a recap, what were the events and the motivation of writing the first book? And as far as the synopsis of that first book, what were the findings you had at that time, and how it relates to your personal interaction with these grays, as well as the gray hybrid children, which is a key component of the story?
Well, I was convinced basically by my friends at the time who were UFO researchers. One was a lifelong abductee, and another guy, Brent Rains, he's been in the field for like 6 years. And I was living in Tennessee, and I had met them actually going to see Stanton Friedman speak in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and we just kind of struck up a friendship, and we started doing a lot of various kind of experiments, all kinds of stuff together related to the paranormal. And once I trusted them and knew their background and everything like that, and I started revealing my story because up until that time, I had still been very kind of quiet about it, even though I had had a lot of memories breaking through, and I describe it all in the first book. I ended up my experiences started when I was 5 years old in southern Illinois in a farm, and it was to this day a very vivid memory of that. But a lot of my early memories were suppressed, and I ended up in therapy in my early 20s with severe anxiety, and I couldn't figure out why. After basically the second therapist, I dropped the first one. I wasn't getting anywhere, and I had the breakthrough where all this stuff that was locked in my subconscious started coming through. And when it did, it was just like the floodgates were open. And I don't know why that I remembered so much stuff, but at first I didn't accept that. I didn't want it to be real, but it started explaining a lot of things that happened to me when I was younger. I had strange scars that I would have looked at. Doctors couldn't explain them. Chronic nosebleeds when I was younger that over and over I went to so many doctors they couldn't fix it. And so then, after telling them, what had been happening to some of the stuff, and comparing to, because I comparing to the, like experiences with them, because I could never make it through, like I'd start Bud Hopkins, some of his couple of his books, John Mack, who I really admire, his work. It was psychologically, I couldn't do it. I couldn't deal with it. I would start. This is after I had even went to therapy. I could still never make it through any of these books about the subject, So I never had any intentions of ever writing one. But when I realized that I could help people like myself, that was my biggest motivation. It really upsets me because a lot of people, skeptics especially, like, oh, if a guy's got a book out, well, forget it. He's just trying to get rich, which is a joke. I mean, there's no real money in it. And, the time that you put into it is enormous. But I knew I had a lot to offer. I had, because I remembered so many incidents. And I knew that if I could get through it, I wanted to be like a voice for other people out there that like, look, I'm just a regular guy, you know. I was just a country boy in Southern Illinois that this happened to. Never asked for it, but I started learning more about it, a lot more about it, and I used my experiences to teach other people in that first book. And you know, I got some great contributors to it. Brad Steiger, world famous author. Kathleen Martin, you know, I adore her. Dr. Sprinkle, I mean, you know, he did a lot of stuff in the field, and they were gracious enough to contribute. And Brent Raines did as well as my friend Sandy Nichols. So, you know, it's kind of with their encouragement. And I knew that, and I hoped the whole point of it was to be able to make more awareness of the subject, you know, to people, to let them know, you know, the reality of the subject. And that more than ever, though, was to actually help other abductees.
Yeah, that's my motivation too, is to pay it forward in some way, because what happened, I had, you know, the benefit of having a great mentor, Barbara Bartholik, and I had a still to this day have a close connection with E.B. Lorgan, despite our wide geographical separation. So I was always thankful that I had people that I can bounce this off of, but I didn't always start out that way. Because I came from San Jose, California, and I don't know about now, but San Jose was somewhat of a, seemed to me anyway, to be kind of a UFO backwater, despite all the weird spookiness, military, ET, UFO activity there. I just wasn't able to reach out and network with people, and it wasn't until I moved to San Diego that I finally met all these like-minded people that I could, you know, openly share with. And that was such a relief. I can't tell you how good that made me feel to finally be able to talk to people unreservedly about this.
And James, that's one of the things that I tell. I've been contacted. I've lost count. It's well into the hundreds of people who have contacted me. And people, the public doesn't realize that this is not only a worldwide phenomenon, it is huge. It's massive numbers, and it happens to people from all walks of life. There's people that's contacted me that I can't talk about that are well known. And you know, like, and it's like famous, there's famous musicians, you know, there's, it doesn't, these guys don't pick and choose. They don't care where, you know, if you satisfy their genetic makeup, I'm talking as far as the grays, that's all they care about. They don't care, you know, whether, what your occupation is, or where you're at geographically, anything like that. But just like what you said, there's so many people out there, you know, when you felt better after talking to like-minded individuals, and that's what we need in this field, especially in the abduction part of the field, because we're kind of the ugly stepsister of the field, you
Still
know. I
are.
mean,
Still are. I
there's
mean, the whole concept of abductions is left by the wayside as far as all this disclosure talk is concerned. We're the
absolutely.
ones, or the rubber meets the road, guys and gals, that had to live with this, but we're being ex systematically excluded in my book.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. You know, I have been and participated in a lot of television stuff, and a lot of you know, speaking engagement type things. And that's always the case. You know, it's like, I did one where I was like the main feature, ended up drawing more people than anybody that's a lot of these people on television shows on a regular basis, you know. So there's a definite interest in it, but it's the powers that be, you know, and that seem to dictate, like, well, maybe they can accept, you know, the ongoing disclosure thing. Maybe they can accept, you know, random people seeing various lights in the sky or things like that. But the fear factor really kicks in when we're like, I'm not so sure the public can accept that these guys are taking human beings against the will most of the time. Oh, sorry, something fell here. And you know, doing whatever they want with them, and we can't stop it, you know. So that part of things, I think, bothers the public. Like, and maybe that's kind of the stigma where a lot of people don't want to touch it, you know. But if there's anybody that's got information about the phenomenon, it's the people that's experienced it.
Because we've had to deal with it since childhood, and then we've had to deal with these traumatic memories. Because I went through a similar phase that you did, because when I came to realization, 88 was a big year, but I still had didn't have a conceptual framework for it. But 1990, it was so in my face with, you know, reptilian gray showing up in my bedroom, a gray looking out at my TV at me. So I became very skittish. Back then, like my buddies, my party buddies would come around and like tap on my window. Hey, Bartley, what's going on? You want to go out and do something, right? They'd come and tap on my window. I'd jump out of my seat, right? And then when I was a boy, I would lay there with the lights on in my bedroom and I would try to sleep beneath a mound of blankets and pillows because I was so scared with the lights on. And I'd have a little air pocket in there. When the air would grow stale, I would lift the corner of the bed sheet, inhale some oxygen, and close it up again. And that's me hiding out, right? In bra with my light on in my own bedroom. So people don't understand the level of trauma that we go through. And you know, I'm so glad that you're out there doing this. Now, as far as the hybridization agenda, right? Because of course, the powers that be don't want it to be let out that a great number of people are being abducted against their will. But when you do the overlay that they're doing some kind of long-standing hybridization agenda between us and them being the various ET races involved in the genetic hybridization, that adds a whole nother complexity and seriousness to this. And that was the crux of your book. You talked earlier about genetic markers. What seems from your perspective and your investigations, do some of these ET races, especially the grays that are doing this hybridization, what are the common factors they look for in people like us?
Well, first of all, it's definitely family, familial genetics. Like, you know, there's more and more cases where, I found out after I start talking to my family that my mother had had experience when she was actually she had me very young, and she, it was maybe a year before. And she had been taken, was put in a chair, and she was describing, she saw at the time what looked like advanced computer equipment, but of course, you know, she's 80, you know, so it wasn't invented at that time. And I don't think she ever talked about that because, you know, back then, who are you going to talk to, you know? And then I discovered that even my great grandfather like had a lot of very similar things as I did or do. And so, you know, I wondered like how many generations that maybe did it go back, you know? So in our case, genetically, and what I found most there's not a definitive thing, but it seems like a Celtic bloodline for some reason, you know, some and the complete opposite of that, some sort of Native American connection, which is a very wide spectrum, you know. So that seems to be, you know, a lot of people talk about the RH blood, and there could be something to that as well. You know, I don't know what kind of blood I have. I just know that I've been told it's very rare. So if RH is rare, you know, it's not really my lane. I haven't went down there, but there is something maybe to that because it's supposedly, you know, they've said there's like 60 some percent of people have RH blood that's been taken, you know. So, but from the people that I've talked to and from what I've read about and research about, that seems to be the links for whatever reason, those particular genetic lines. But I think a lot of it has to do in overall with just our human bodies. They're certainly not interested in our intellect because, that's self-explanatory. Look at us, you know, look what we've, what we're doing to the planet. And I can tell you flat out that most people, especially those that have been taken more than once. I mean, I started calling it lifers, back in 2013 when my first book came out, and now I think that that term has kind of caught on because I've seen more and more people refer to that. And when I first was saying it, it was like, if you've been start to be taken more than once, you're going to be taken for the rest of your life. Now, it may not be like everybody's like, well, he says, well, how many times have you been taken? Who knows? Because nobody remembers everything, and there could be also big gaps. I've went sometimes 2 or 3 years, nothing happened, but then there'll be spurts where it could happen 2 or 3 times in a week and a half time, so it's completely unpredictable. And that's why when you talk about when you were a child and you have that fear, I've heard so many people say the same thing, and I can 100% relate. And I always tell people, like, one of my advice, if your child comes up, now I know people say, oh, well, children have vivid imaginations, and they do. But when that kind of fear is unnatural, and they start telling you about little people in their room or something, even along the lines of that, even if the alien, even the Greys are famous for screen memories. So, oh, there was a large deer looking through my window, or there was a large owl. Like Mike Cleland talks about the owl connected. It's true. And so pay attention to them. Don't dismiss it. Like my parents, I was dismissed, even though I didn't even know what was even going on. When you're a child, you really can't figure it out. So you just know this is not supposed to happen. Like when I first, the first time it happened to me, I'm telling you, it scars you for the rest of your life. Because I was 5 years old, I walked across the room. There wasn't streetlights where I lived, and there's still not. I Google Earth that farmhouse is still there, and I almost was going to put photos of it in the new book, just to give a people an idea. But I think just me describing it can kind of give you a pretty good idea. And I didn't want anybody to try to find it, as out of respect to the people who live there now, but there was no street lights and stuff. And so when you see some bright light outside your window, it's like, what's causing that? But I remember, distinctly just walking, getting, I was coaxed actually to the window, and I talk about it in the first book. But and we didn't have blinds, because there was no reason, because there was no neighbors, but we had like these kind of wispy white curtains, and just walking up to that large, those large windows in the farmhouses, and just taking my hand and pulling back those curtains, and there it was, literally that face, like right there. And that's just something that just, no matter, even happened at 5 years old or whatever age, but especially for the young, when it happens to you young. And then, that's something that you don't forget ever, all these years
And at the
later.
time, you don't have a conceptual framework for it, right?
No,
And you know
nothing,
what it reminds me
nothing.
also of? You probably saw this too, the interrupted journey based on Fuller's book about the Barney and Betty Hill, right? And then James Earl Jones played Barney Hill, and I forget who
Right.
played Betty Hill, but that movie came on. I think it was on the ABC affiliate in San Jose. Or maybe I was living in Daly City, New San Francisco at the time when I was even younger. But that scene when the ET is right outside the car window, that terrified me so much, right? And that terror, all things related to UFOs, even though I was, pretty interested in all things paranormal, never dreamed for a second it had anything to do with me. But it manifested itself, this trepidation towards the subject, in a number of ways. Like, I was a big fan of the band UFO, the rock band, but I didn't like the title of the band. And then when Mork and Mindy came out, everyone was still
I was a
talking
fan of
about it.
UFO for the same reason. Lights out in London.
When Mork and Mindy came out, everyone was talking about it. But the concept of an alien showing up in like Boulder, Colorado, somewhere, I didn't like that. I forced myself to watch it only because everyone was talking about it, and after a while I liked it. I thought it was funny. But yes, people don't understand the level of trepidation, the level of trauma that if it's not healed properly and processed out of us, we still retain that in our body memory and in our subconscious. It's still there.
Absolutely. I write about that quite extensively in the new book. Actually, I quote Lorgan also with Alien Love Bite because I think she does excellent work and she's 100% spot on in my opinion. And we can maybe get into that later with the implant thing, but the PTSD is characteristics are across the board very, very similar. And there was a nurse, I can't remember her name, but I wrote about it. And she called it PAS, post-abduction syndrome. And she correlated how closely it was to PTSD, And so there's so many people that's, and there's nobody to turn to. That's a big, big problem. And there's so many people that I have talked to, and then they'll get off the phone, they'll getting ready to hang up, and they'll be thanking me. And they're like, I just needed someone to talk to, because I thought I was going crazy, And I talked about it also in the first book, Suffering in Silence, because that's exactly what it is, because as a child, especially, you can't comprehend what's happening to you because, like you said, there's nothing to correlate it to. What I didn't the now commercialized, there's all the little grays everywhere and gray aliens, toys and everything. But back then there was nothing like that. And I think, I don't even know when the first depictions of gray started coming. Maybe it was Betty and Barney Hill. I don't know. But see, we have these, it's all locked in our subconscious. And so there's triggers that happen. It's PTSD triggers, it's like, and I think that a lot of us are hypervigilant, sleepers, just the slightest thing, gonna wake up. Because I went for years like dreading to go to sleep, like literally years. And even to this day, it kind of bothers me a little bit
Yes.
because there's no rhyme or reason to when they're going to come again. So I've had a precursors before for a while. I don't know if this ever happened to you, but I would hear like this low frequency hum, and nobody else can hear it, like I would say, describe it, it's this low pulsating frequency hum. And I started realizing it was like a precursor to an event.
Like they're
Like
almost like
it
they're
would be
tuning into
like,
you or something.
yeah. And I don't know. I was like, is this happening through implant? Why am I the only person hearing this? And I've talked to some others that told me like, no, I've heard these things too, don't hear it every time, but it was like, it would put fear. Like, I'm like, oh man, something's going to happen because I don't know if it's that night, the next night, or sometime soon, they're coming. And,
Yes.
so that's
It's the
another, like,
dread, the anticipation, waiting for the shoe to drop. That was probably the worst thing about it, because I would hear like tones in what seemed to me to be my left ear, but it was internal, right? It wasn't anything audible. It was something inside my head, like a high-pitched tone, or like you described, like a low hum, or sometimes Morse type beeps even, right? And so I would start to get what Evie calls this prodromal feeling, like, oh, just getting a creepy feeling of being watched and observed. And then, and like what you said, when I was younger, especially, I was so terrified of the onset of evening. And, by now I'm a young adult, and there were times that I'm not ashamed to say it. I didn't really have much responsibilities other than going to work back then, right? I would drink myself into a stupor because I would rather be laying in bed and the whole room spinning around, from the effects of the alcohol, than be laying there like in terror. Because if I'm in that comet, if I'm in that stupor state, then I don't really care what happens at that point,
right.
but that's only going to last and work for so long, but
Yeah, been there. I know exactly what you're talking about. I was kind of went through a few years like that as well. And I think it was sort of a method, escape mechanism, Because once you have this realization, and I will tell anybody out there that's watching or listening that, if you think that you may have had like maybe one experience or something, then kind of just let it go. Just let it go. If it's something that you're having repeated memory, actual memories, there's a the dreams of these events are different than regular dreams. So you will know to be able to distinguish between the two. But if you're having something like that pop up, because it's coming, like you said earlier, from your subconscious, then it's probably a chance that there's something really happening there. Because there's people out there think, "Oh, this is cool. I want to be taken," that kind of thing. It's not. It's not at all. But I always tell people, like, because it's best to leave it be if it's not affecting your everyday life. If you're starting to do like what happened to both of us, like, at one time in my life, I was the same as you. I started drinking too much. I'm a musician. I was playing out, and everybody's giving you drinks. And, it's that they're both escapes. In fact, music is still an escape to me now. But then you realize, well, this can't go on forever. This is not really helping the matter anyway, And then that's when I turned to start looking within, and I really got heavily into meditation, which I still do. And it's helped me tremendously. But if you feel like that you're starting to exhibit some of these PTSD signs and it's affecting your everyday life, that's when you got to do something about it. That's when you got to reach out. There's darn people out there that will listen. And there's getting more and more therapists that's getting open to it, especially in major cities. Surprisingly, I mean, I filmed a pilot that never got picked up, but they hooked me up with some great people. That it was in Los Angeles, which of course is a pretty open-minded city, but very professional people, and so they're there. And if not, you'd be surprised. The people like that would be willing to listen. Because a lot of people don't want to say anything because they're afraid of what people's going to think of them if they say, "Oh, I believe this stuff," And then you get into the religious connotations of it, which opens up a whole Pandora's box. Because I've said this over and over, so one of my big things about disclosure is like, I'm not sure, and this is everybody's always got ticked off at me about this, and I've been saying it for 12 or 13 years now publicly, but I don't think we're there. From what I've actually had communication with the beings and my own personal opinions of this, we have to get to a certain evolved spiritual basis. Like we are not there yet. We are far from there. In order to join, the so-called like galactic brotherhood, I mean, whether these ever all these different species, and there's not we're I know we're talking a lot about the grays, but there is a lot of different species out there, and they all have different agendas. Some of them, I do think the reptilians and grays are working together, as well as with our governments of the world, especially American government, positive of it. I've experienced it. But there's probably a hierarchy, that's out there among the beings, so, but the fear that the disclosure, I just think it, if we laid all that on people at one time, it would be catastrophic. And people like us, to me, and I just wrote about this in the new book, it's like we're slow drip acclimation. That's what I call it. It's like, look, I mean, in my case, when I first came out, I wanted to prove to everybody, like, oh, okay, I'm not crazy. This really happened. And I was just hell bent on proving it. I'm well past that now because I've did everything. I mean, I've given more proof than probably any case that I know in history. And so if you don't believe me at this point, that's on you,
Right.
because if you don't want to accept it, that's your own fear setting in, Because I mean, I've had went to numerous doctors, looking at these scars and stuff, and especially the ones up on my spine, and thinking, you know, asking me when I had surgery. I've never had back surgery, and I've ran special blood tests. You know, they're like, oh, well, there's a certain kind of disease that can cause, you know, these random scarring on your body, you know. And I said, okay, I'll do it. Run the test on him, take the blood, you know. Come back. No, that's not it. And I would ask him, you know, well, what do you think it is? I mean, I've been examined several doctors, different doctors, and they've all told me the same thing. They have no explanation. And of course, they're not going to go out and down the alien route, you know. And, you know, I was taken with another witness, you know, that I wrote about in the first book, and was actually regressed, filmed, with this Dr. Judy Blume in Los Angeles. And the people from Ancient Aliens have all this film, and you know, actually got even more answers about that experience of the hybrid of the fetus being taken from my girlfriend at the time. And she's went on since the first book came out. You know, she's actually went on several shows. She's been contacted and completely backed up the story, even though we hadn't even spoken in years. And I did a Destination America show where, you know, we flew out to Vegas, and they interviewed her separately from me. And when the producer guy came back, and I said, how did it go? And they said, well, you know, A, it was very, I could tell it was very traumatic for her, which of course it was. And B, you know, she backed up your story 100%. You know, she said exactly the same thing of what happened that night, you know. But when I got regressed by Dr. Bloom, I always blamed myself for it. And I had felt the guilt from that for years, because I'm like, man, who wants to be with me? Because, you know, you got this chance of being taken too, you know. And that's what happened with her. And I know she's really probably scarred from it, because it was a very, very traumatic event. And they let us both remember it on purpose. And I think that was once again to test like our emotional reaction to it, you know. But when I was regressed, you know, there was a film crew there, and Erin Ryder, she's been on a bunch of shows. She was actually the producer of that episode, and she they had cameras all set up, you know, and I had never been regressed before. And I didn't want the narrative being set by Dr. Bloom, you know, like, because that was a big rap on Bud, you know, like they were just like, oh, well, he or anybody that does these regressions, they were like, they'll lead them into your answers, you know. So I asked before they started filming, I said, look, can I talk to this to Dr. Bloom before we do this? And I told her, I was like, first of all, I'm not even sure this is going to work. You know, I don't know if I can be regressed or not. So I'll just tell you that flat off. Because I was kind of on the fence about it. Like, you know, because maybe it was so traumatic, I'm going to not let myself go there. You know, like I was a little concerned about that. But I agreed to do it. But, and I said, so there's that. And then she started explaining to me, like, there's different levels you can go. And she says, well, how deep do you want to go? You know, and I'm like, I didn't know there was. You categorize it in these different levels, but I said, I want to go all the way. You know, that's just my personality. Like, I don't like, you know, half, you know what, do stuff, you know, like if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it. And I says, unless you think I'm going to have a heart attack or something, keep it going. I said, I want as many answers as I can, because I'm like everybody else. Nobody has all the answers. And not even people like me, you know. It's like, so we can all learn from each other. So, and I told her, I says, here's the deal. I know you know why you're here. You know what the show is about and everything. But I don't want any kind of leading answers. You know, you do your regular thing and we'll just see what happens. Or leading questions. And you do your regular thing and we'll just see what happens. And it wasn't the best situation to be under, because most people that go and do this probably aren't filmed, number one. And if they are, it might just be their friend filming it or something, you know. I mean, I had all these different cameras set up, and there was a 8 to 10 person crew there, and a couple producers, and you know, besides me and the doctor, you know. And it was in somebody's house, like in the Hollywood Hills or something, some big mansion they were filming in. And when we did, we did one of the events, and I guess because it was one of the more traumatic events, it did go back to that first, the first incident. And I had always, there was a cutoff like of my memories. But once under I got into the regression, I actually remembered more about it. And, I actually, that was one of the things that I revised in the new book, that I went back and I continue with what my memory was of that event. Because I guess, it was so traumatic that some for some reason it had stopped at a certain point, And I remembered more after what happened after that the tall gray took the fetus. And I go into a lot more detail about this, for those of you listening to stuff, how they had set everything up and how many grays there were, and they made a clear path, from where they had me laying and where she was at, and they were doing this procedure on her, and I could totally see everything. And I remember afterwards, like I was very angry when it was going on, and I was screaming at these things, and I was telling them that I was going to kill them. And if I could have got out of their power, I would have taken as many of them out as I possibly could have. That's how angry, the rage was just unbelievable. Seeing them take this fetus and then making me watch it, and I had tried to turn away, even during the thing, but I
Just
couldn't move
hold
my
that
body.
thought. Just hold that thought. A quick question. I don't want you to lose your train of thought, but did you get the impression the fetus that was extracted was the result of the union between you and your girlfriend, or was it a hybridized fetus? In other words, was it a human fetus you think they took, or an alien human fetus?
I don't know. I've wondered that for years. It's 50-50. I don't know. I didn't get a good enough look at it. They took it, and the tall gray was the one that one of the tall grays was the one that actually did the procedure, and immediately turned around, took two or three steps, and left the room. Like went through this entryway, and so I never really knew that. But after that, what I remembered under regression was like I just kind of had this give up thing. Like I just went silent, and she went silent. I think she was like in a state of shock because before she was screaming, "Please, that's my baby. Please don't take my baby," that kind of thing. And while I was over there yelling at them for doing it, and just enraged. And I started apologizing to her. This is the part I never remembered before, and I said, it's all my fault, all that type of stuff like that, and which that's what I always felt. But I just know, and she never replied. She was so, I think she went into like shock. She was almost in a stoic state, just like that had just happened. And after they brought me out, I didn't know it at the time, but like there was tears, like I was just bawling, and I was kind of weak, like they brought me up and she brought me out of it. And I was like, man, and I was kind of like wiping my face and stuff. And the whole place was just silent. Like everybody, nobody was talking or nothing. Like it was so impactful from not just me, because they were hearing what was going on and what I was seeing. And it got so real for me under the regression. It was like I was there again. It was like I was that deep. And I guess, as it was happening, I was probably also crying as well, And I just sat up and they were asking me if I was okay and stuff, But what it did for me was very helpful, because it when I saw, it gave me like a different view of it, sort of like a Zen view, where I was outside looking in, because I realized like there was no, I was helpless. There was nothing I could do to stop it. And when, and I just quit blaming myself for it after that. Like that very instant, like when I came out of the regression, I quit blaming myself. I was like, it was horrible that it happened. And I just knew that was helpless. You know, like I tried, but it wasn't my fault. If I could have, I would have done something. So I got a lot from that, you know, like I kind of let it go, so to speak. You know, like it was very beneficial to me to go through that kind of regression, you know, even though it was traumatic, you know, but at least you can release some of that stuff, you know. So I do advise people to do that, you know, if you have some kind of if you can just be brave enough to face it again, you know, like face your fear, and that's how you overcome it.
I had to do that too, not through a regression. Barbara Bartholak always told me that I would be very difficult to put under because she just knew from her past experience the kind of person I was that I would resist fanatically, right, to being put under. The times that I have been put under, nothing really new came out. And the one time that I was regressed that I thought was a complete failure because nothing new came up. It had jarred my subconscious enough that a few days later, reading something, it triggered this childhood memory, which for years after this experience, of circa 68, 69, I would have been 4 or 5 years old. I told anyone who was around me about this little gray man I'd seen in my bedroom, right? And then, very typical for people like us, it was just suddenly removed from my conscious memory. I just completely forgot about that incident that I'd formerly been telling everybody about. Until I had what I thought was a failed regression. And then a few days later, I read something and it was like a zip file that opened up in my mind. And every little detail that had been suppressed came out in real time, right? And so I can relate with that. And as far as your girlfriend at the time, did she have a prior history that you're aware of to these experiences?
Not that I know of. No. I know that, you know, she did say that ever since that happened, that she's been like sleeps with the light on, you know, kind of thing. You know, it's just like we were as children, you know, that she's always been worried that they'll come back, you know, and see, that's the thing. Like I think when you're a lifer, you get to the point where you don't want it to happen. You sort of dread it, but you kind of, at least with me anyway, I got to the point where it's like you have to like let it go, and accept it. Acceptance is the key. You know, it's like they're going to come. They're probably going to come. I don't know. You know, I don't know where the cutoff is. You know, I mean, I actually, you know, thought, well, they're using me genetically, you know, so they're extracting sperm and they're using me genetically. So what if I get a vasectomy? You know, it's like, so that was, and I did, for that reason. And it was later that I found out that, that doesn't do anything because they can still just go straight into to, you know, to your testicles and still extract. So that was my foolishness, you know, of trying to, before my, when I was still in the resistance stage of it, you know, and now when something happens, and you know, there is things that there's I write about this in second in the new book Aftermath, Child of the Grace Aftermath, because one of the benefits of, there's benefits to it, you know, like, and you have to start pulling the positives out of it, of these experiences. And I started going through and kind of like writing down like how my life has changed, even though these traumatic experiences, but it kind of makes you become the person that you are now. And it's like, look, you know, I see the world like probably a lot different than a lot of people that's never had these experiences because of them. But I do know the reality of what these things are. So I'm not living my life with blinders on, you know. I know that we are certainly not alone in the universe. But one of the things that I've really embraced, and I've found this over and over and over, and maybe you can tell me if this is the case with you, but well, there's two things. There's a paranormal connection that when I came out with the first book in 2013, I mean, there was people just chuckling at me when I was saying, because I wrote about a lot of paranormal stuff, because I was like, there's a connection here. There's a connection, Because a lot of people that's had these experience abduction experiences, especially people that's had multiple experiences, there's increased paranormal activity around them. There just is. And now I'm seeing a lot of these researchers who back in the day was kind of giving me the, like, sure, buddy, saying the same thing. Here it is, 13 years later, they're like, oh, you know what? Yeah, there's this paranormal connection. Well, I was saying that 13 years ago, so. And the second thing that I'm seeing more and more people accept and come out with is the psychic abilities
Yes.
connection. And that's probably the most prominent one of all. And there's the cases in the new book, I took four cases, other people, because they wanted to, three of the four wanted to remain anonymous, but they wanted their stories out there, and they have great, great stories, And in those cases, it was the same type of thing, psychic abilities. One lady was a full-fledged medium after her cases, and it started even when she was a child. After, she would, her mom actually had her, they were Catholic, and her mom, after she walked up to her mother and hugged her, and then she knew her mom was pregnant, and her mom hadn't told anybody. And I think she even said something about what the sex of the baby was. And her mom thought she was possessed by demons, and literally had her admitted into Catholic school and had an exorcism on her. And turned out she was right on both accounts, because the only person her mom had told, I think, was, I don't even know if she taught, I can't remember exactly. I write about it, but I can't remember exactly. Maybe the priest and the dad, or maybe hadn't even told the dad yet, or something like that. And, so that's how, like, like, man, that's an extreme case of revealing your psychic abilities from these experiences. But she's like a full-fledged medium now. But I've used that as a positive. Like, that's how I got into, I kind of have the same type of thing, and I got into a lot of the, I don't want to say, like, ghost investigations, because I would use that to help people. Like, look, I can sense energy. I can walk into places and feel the energy, and I know, I can sense energy on people. And I can, I've went into southern plantations here with other investigators, and the owners will be walking around. I was like, this room up, I'm talking multiple rooms, and I would say, this room, the red room, the red bedroom, the one with the blue paint down here, they were like, that's true. Those are the two most active rooms in the place. The only difference for me was I felt the energy. It became very thick and heavy in there, and I knew there was activity in there, that type of thing. But what I started doing with that, a lot of people do that stuff for kicks. I didn't do it for kicks, because I did it to help people on both sides, like the people that crossed over that were lost, didn't know where to go, and the people on this side to get healing. And so I use that as a positive, I helped a lot of people like that. And I think that what happens to us is these, well, I know that we're being taken through portals. I've seen it, flat out seen it. And, people say, well, I was taken through my ceiling or through my car. Well, in essence, to you were, but you were really just taken through a portal, because they can manipulate these portals. Even we're starting to say that we're getting close to doing that ourselves. I've been seeing some science articles on that. So you think these guys haven't been doing, they're so far ahead of us, it's not even funny. And quite frankly, that's probably where we got the technology, right? But and so that there's that type of things. And just also, like, I kind of let go of dogmatic religion. And just became, I became a very spiritual person because of it, like, more so. And I opened myself up to, I still admire and like the teachings of Jesus, but I also like the teachings of Buddha. I find them very similar, actually. It's just like, hey, just, just be a good person, and respect the earth and everything in it. Take an altruistic view, and that's what I've done. And it's turning me into, get a new perspective of that kind of thing. So, but I think, being back to the portals, I kind of jumped the track here, but I think us being taken through the portals like changes does something to the way we vibrate, like our energy vibrations. And so we become, when we go back into, and it could be a dimensional thing, like, we don't even know these guys are even extraterrestrials. They could be ultra-terrestrials, they could just be dimensional beings. But I do know that somehow we're altered through, I think it's the vibration rate of being taken through these portals, which we become more of a beacon for those on the other side, and they kind of seek us out, And what seems like a haunting is really just somebody trying to get your attention for help, a lot of times, but people don't understand it, so they fear it, and the lights blink and the doors open by itself, and there are spirits out there that are kind of trapped and angry and trying to do mean stuff, but generally what I found is most of them need help, and so you can use these abilities to help those on that side and the abilities to help hear people here, connect. And when I don't embrace it that much anymore because it became almost overpowering for me, because it would be, there's so many out there that need help, and it becomes a lot to deal with. It can almost consume you. So there's a lot of positive you can draw from it, if you just start analyzing your life and pulling from it and see like, wow, that it's really helped me in this aspect or that aspect.
Acceptance part, and that did a lot for me to help get over the fear. For me, you mentioned earlier that you had difficulty getting through certain books. For me, my way of coming to grips with this is pre-internet, of course, was I had to just read everything I could about the abduction subject, right? And despite, the fears and misgivings, and I'm sure at some level there was some ET interference trying to elbow its way and saying, don't read that, you're going to be scared, and all this other stuff, right? For example, the communion cover terrified me, right? And that's before I realized I was having abduction experiences. Eastridge Mall was a big mall. I don't know if it's still there in the south east side of San Jose, California, and they had a B. Dalton's there, if you remember that bookstore. And this is when the communion first came out, and they would have the display of that big alien on the cover, and I would go clear across the other side of the mall to avoid it, right? And if there were times when I had to walk by it, I'd almost walk by with my eyes shut, right? And so, fast forwarding, after I had a series of experiences in 1990, the only thing I could think to do was to read up on the subject to, allay the fear and develop more understanding about it. So I basically cleaned out every alien abduction book B. Dalton's had. I had to drive 45 minutes to get there. One book left, which I hadn't read yet, and that was Communion. And I forced myself, okay, I'm going to read this book finally. And I did. And the one takeaway that I got out of it, right? Well, a few takeaways, but there's a part in that book. I think Streber was talking about his first conscious remembrance of of an encounter in his cabin in upstate New York, and he was being carried by several beings, right? A few beings, and he wrote something to the effect of, "At this point, I knew something was terribly wrong," and I know that abductees everywhere can relate to that statement because, in 1990, the big ET event that I had, where they came into my bedroom, took me up in a big ship, and everything just unraveled from there. It was like, something is terribly wrong because I can't wake up from this. I can't do what I want. There seems to be these beings here that have control over me, right? You get to this point where this can't be a dream, right? Even though for days and weeks afterwards, I told myself and others I had a terrible nightmare, but deep down I knew, right? In the time we got left, you alluded earlier to a to an implant slash military slash reptilian gray connection. I'd like your thoughts about that because when people really delve into this, especially those having the experiences, and like yourself, my experiences came cyclically. I'd have a dry spell for a while, and then whammo, I'd have a series of events and sightings and what have you that would last for weeks at a time. And then, aside from an odd waking up with a mark every now and then, I would seem to go into a cold spell. And then a few years down the track, it starts up again. That's been my pattern, right? And for those of us who really delve into this, we realize that there's other beings besides the grays that are involved in this. And then if one really delves into it, and if they get the right regression work and they piece together enough memories, they'll begin to see there are other players, oftentimes operating behind the scenes, oftentimes quite blatant and in your face. And the reptilians and the military aspect relates to that, because you alluded earlier to the difficulties the powers that be would have in admitting that abductions are going on. Well, you overlay the fact that, in all likelihood, going back at least as far as the Eisenhower administration, elements of the military and the government and the industrial complex are in cahoots with some of the very same beings that are abducting us, right? So
No doubt.
of course they're not going to admit to that, right? Because to admit that even one person is having an encounter is bad enough, right? Because we're paying taxes. They're supposed to be stopping this kind of thing from happening. But if it turns out that they're actually in collusion with these beings, so I know that's kind of like a big generalized topic, but your thoughts on the reptilians, what you've observed of them, the military connection, and the implant connection. And we can continue, in the second half, but definitely would like your thoughts here in the first half on that.
Well, I do want to, before we even get to that, I want to talk about, and this actually kind of ties in a little bit with the government. And when I say government, I'm not talking about the Congress and Senate. They're not the ones running things, so I'll just say that. But I was talking about the evidence. I didn't finish out with all the evidence I have provided. During that same time I was filming that show, I took a polygraph, and it was also in the same scenario. There was a film crew there. I had three or four cameras on me set up, all these people, and they brought in a guy named Joseph Paolilia. He was a former Presidential Detail Secret Service. This guy's a top-notch guy. So they didn't just get some random polygraph examiner, took that, it was filmed, passed. Also during that, and this is the thing that really got some of these people we're talking about, we can keep calling them government, even though I just want to preface that it's, I'm not talking, when I'm talking about these are the, we'll call them secret government. So I gotta watch what I say, but this is what really got more on their radar for me, and why I've been quiet for the last almost 3 years. Because I took what's called a qEEG brain scan, and it was administered by a guy named Dr. Dario Nardi. He's a PhD out of UCLA. He's wrote a book on it. He's award-winning guy. So he's top, once again, top-notch neurologist. So and during that, the way that worked is even a level above a polygraph, because people say, oh, well, you can trick a polygraph, and I guess if you're really, really good, maybe you could, I don't know. But this thing, the qEEG, you can't trick, because they wire the electrodes on you. And it's going to sense what parts of your brain is triggered when they're asking you questions. And so if you're making stuff up, if you're basically lying, it's going to trigger the creative part of your brain, because you got to make something up. Whereas if you're not, it comes from the lobe of your brain that has to do with memory. And so I agreed to do it. I didn't even know what it was, and he did that. And they started with some basic questions, like cognitive questions, like he would say a word association type thing, like how many, kind of like these, some of these dementia, basic dementia tests or something, like, and then you would say the words again that he gave you in order up to however far you could go. And I went really far, and he was like pretty shocked by it. And I told him, he wanted me to get in a calm state, so I asked if I could just meditate for give me a few minutes, you know, and then I was already wired up. And I said, I'll try to get the brain activity down to a minimum, you know, so that you have a good baseline to go by. And I did, even though under those circumstances, I don't know how I did it because I had all those people around. But so when he did it, he didn't say anything at that time that I didn't know, like, what was going to be the result, you know. And so they got back with me after it was over with. I think like maybe the next day or two, I was down there for like 5 days filming all this stuff. And they said, yeah, you know, you 100% passed this brain scan, meaning like everything you answered about your experiences came from the area of your brain that has to do with memory. And he said, and not only did it come from the area of your brain that has to do with memory, it had emotions associated with it, like the part of your brain, you know, was also associated with this memory. You can't fake that. So I was like, oh, great, you know. And so that never, nothing ever, that show was filmed, the pilot, and Aaron caught a hold of me, and there was they were lining up a second episode. It's Prometheus Productions, the same people that does Ancient Aliens, and I've been on their show several times and met with Kevin Burns, who owns a company. And you know, everything was going great. So they lined up for me to film a second show in Arkansas. And the premise of the show was that I was going to be the main featured person as an abductee. We were going to go around and interview other abductees, and I would be trying to help them, which is what I was doing anyway, explain maybe, you know, answer what questions of them that they had from them that they had. And so that's why I submitted to all these tests, because they were going to do these same kind of tests on other people. And I'm like, well, I can't ask them to do it if I haven't done it myself, you know. So and she had got Erin had got a hold of me, and they'd lined up all everything, it was plane and you know, the tickets, everything. And I was going to meet Linda Moult Howe in Arkansas, and she had somebody that we, you know, that we were gonna talk to or whatever and film the second episode. And because they had two other major networks interested in this pilot to pick it up. Well, maybe 3 weeks later, before this even, you know, maybe only a week or two before I was even supposed to leave, a different producer got a hold of me. And he says, ah, you know, we're going to have to put this on hold. And I was like, everything's already set, you know. And he's like, yes, well, I don't know. Word came down from the top, you know, like, you got to put it on hold. And I was like, oh, okay. He goes, well, we'll get back with you. We'll let you know. Never happened. That's just the beginning. I mean, I get into all this stuff in the book. And let me tell you, when you read it all, your jaw is going to drop. When you start talking about the power that this so-called secret government has, when they want something stopped. So, I was figuring you see where I'm going with this already. So, because I was happy, you know, hey man, they're actually doing a show about abductees. Thank God, it's about time, you know. I think it was going to break it open for us, for people like us, and bring all this awareness, which is what I try to do every time I do an interview. And Prometheus got a hold of me again, and he said, I thought they were getting hold of me again for the show, but this was, man, I don't know what the dates were. I don't have them written down in front of me here, but it was enough time that went by, like, you know, like maybe they were going to bring this original pilot back. But it was once again for they wanted me to film another Ancient Aliens. I was like, oh, okay. I don't know what happened with the last show, but, you know, and they said, well, but we want to film you doing another QEEG brain scan. And I said, why? You own the film of me doing one already. You know, just use that. You know, because I live, on the Gulf Coast. You know, that's LA's a long way. You know, it's quite a trip. So anyway, they're like, no, we just want to film another one. And, you know, and this time Nick Pope's going to ask questions, and but Dr. Nario is going to be the same neurologist and everything. It's like, okay. So they actually, I flew out there. I got up, still dark out, got to the airport, flew, had a big layover, got to LA, and you know how LAX is. Waited forever for my driver, then rode another well over an hour to some location. I was even lost, man. I've been to LA gazillions of times. I don't even know where we were at. And we went in this plaza where this office was at, you know, and that's where they were filming. And Nick was there, and Dr. Nardi was there. And they explained to me what was going on. And so this time, man, I was tired when I got there because it's like the same day. You know, most of the time you fly to do these things, you get a night's rest and you start early the next morning, you know. So I was like, man, you know, and plus there's our 2 hour time gap to begin with, West Coast time. But I'm like, I'm a trooper, you know, so I'm good. Okay. And I hadn't hardly eaten anything, you know, and they didn't have like the usual spread or food, you know, they just had like some chips and some bananas and stuff. So I ate like some fruit, you know, I'm like starving, and I got some water. And they're telling me, here's what we're doing. You know, they start telling me. So next thing I know, you know, they're wiring me up again, and all the cameras are there, it's all the same thing. And but this time, like Nick's like sitting, he's sitting like, you know, right here in front of me. And I'd only met him briefly, like literally like 10 minutes before this. So we go through, and he was asking him some really, you know, some pretty intense questions. I just answered them honestly, like I always do, and got done with it. And this time, Dr. Nardi, like he just right then and there, like there was no waiting for the results. Like he turned, he had his equipment, he had turned his laptop around with software on, you know, and he's pointing out, he's like, here's your brain lighten up, you know, and this is he explained it all to me again, which I'd already remembered, but and he goes, yeah, this is just remarkable stuff, you know. It's like, you know, what you 100% this is coming from your memory with emotions attached to it. Because they talked about some, you know, Nick asked him a different type of questions this time. And so I already knew the results. And I went back home the next day. That was like a one day thing. They filmed with me all the way to the point where I told them I was going to drop. You know, it's about 2 o'clock in the morning my time, and I had been up. I was like Kiefer Sutherland, you know, from 24. I was coming up on my 24, you know. And so they got a hold of me again and said, can you come out and speak at AlienCon, which was coming up, like, you know. It wasn't immediate, you know, but I'm like, man, too bad we couldn't have just did this all at the same time, you know. So Kevin was nice enough to get my wife Julie a ticket too, and so I'm like, that was nice, you know. And so they set us up good and everything. So we went out there to speak at AlienCon, and they ended up like, I even write a bunch of stuff that happened there, but I won't go into it here for time's sake. But it was great because I ended up like getting transferred initially from, which I thought was a big room, which held about 1,000 people, to a massive auditorium that held about 3,000 people. And then they made sure I was featured in the middle, and they were backstage like, no, put hold them in the middle and all this stuff. You know, I was like, wow, you know, they never treat guys like us, right? But like this good, you know, like, and it went really, really well. And the second event we did, there was even more people. Like it was packed. It drew more people than even the Ancient Aliens crew, you know, the main people like Georgia, all these people like that. And the second one, they let in about 400 or 500 extra people that was standing up all around the edges of the auditorium, you know. And I felt really good about it. You know, I was like, wow, this is people are really, really garnering major interest in the subject. So what happened is they ended up, when they aired it, it was I think season 13. It was an episode called The Taken. So if you ever get a chance to watch it, anybody out there, you'll see what I'm talking about. It turned out to be one of their most popular episodes of the year. And the people that put Prometheus people that put this all on, the producers told me they were very, very pleased with my segment of it. And they asked me to go to the East Coast and do AlienCon. And just do it again the next month. You know, I'm like, yeah, sure. Because I enjoyed it. I thought the crowd was great. And before that happened, they aired the episode. And, you know, I always want to be as presentable as possible because the skeptics are going to attack you. You know, I had a guy attack me about that episode because he says, oh, those electrodes couldn't work because his hair was too greasy. You know, and I'm like, oh my God, man, I know that. Because I was like, dude, you don't realize, like, when they filmed this, I'd been up for like 20 hours. You know, I got dead straight hair, you know, so I had to go into a room and like spray some hairspray on my hair before they did that, because otherwise I'd look like I'd been surfing, you know, with the wind blowing from the beach, you know. But that's the kind of stuff we have to put up with, you know. I go into that too. So much stuff, way too much to go into. That's why it's called Aftermath. I mean, it's jaw-dropping, the amount of stuff I've had to go through to get to talk about stuff like this. And I'm sure you've probably experienced some of it yourself, you know. But what got dangerous for me with these people that we're talking about, I had already experienced all the stuff. Like, my house has been broken into twice, destroying evidence. And we'll talk about that maybe after we take a little, you know, the next go around here. But because I have some very, very compelling evidence aside from everything I've, and they wanted it. And one time they got it. But, you know, I've had my computer's been hacked up, but they're trying to completely download my computer, even though I had like all the best security software. They did all that stuff. But the QEEG brain scan iced it. And all of a sudden, everything changed because they're like, well, this is like evidence beyond evidence. You know, it's like there's been a few people do polygraphs and stuff, but no one, not only that, this guy, no one's at a QEEG brain scan. And not only that, by a top neurologist in Los Angeles, you know, like professor at UCLA with a PhD and has wrote a book and, you know, all this stuff. And on top of that, it was televised, you know. It goes all over the world. You know, ancient aliens get shown, I don't know how many countries, a lot of countries, you know. So that's the kind of stuff they don't want out, you know, because that's like, even if you're the, like I said, if you're even the most staunch skeptic, what are you going to say? You know, it's like, that's science. Like, this, I'm wired up. This is coming, this proves this is true, true memories, you know. So, and I did it twice. I think the second time they were probably told by certain people, run this guy again. Let's maybe he can fail this time. You know, that's why they didn't keep the first footage. And they'd already sequestered the show. They didn't want that getting out. So I think they had me do it a second time because they were hoping that I would fail it. And they didn't. But I will give props to Ancient Aliens for airing it, you know, and they aired it numerous times, probably because, you know, it was so popular. But, and that was the straw that broke the camel's back, as they said, you know, because when that got so popular and that kind of proof, along with everything else that I've mentioned earlier, I think I became a pretty dangerous person to them.
What they did to you also, having you fly in on such short notice, that's like standard operational procedure for them. They like to have us fly in, ideally on a red eye or something, but if they can't do that, they'll have us fly in on another flight. We get there early in the morning. We're all disheveled. We don't have time to freshen up. Oh, by the way, we're going to do this, like we're going to air live this regression or whatever. Or they ask a number of questions when we're, you know, we're still groggy and we're suffering from jet lag and everything else. I mean, they did this to Evie Lorgan. They did this to a number of people.
They do it over and over.
They do it over
and over. You know, the only people that ever treated me right, believe it or not, was a Russian television company.
Oh, really?
They got a hold of me And I'm not, don't get me wrong. I'm not, I don't want people coming at me saying, no, you're, pro-Russian, you can't blame the people. But they said they had an audience of multi-millions, because they went all around the Baltic states, And I was like, this is really a chance for me to let those people, because I've been fortunate enough to, I've been in countries all around the world, spreading this message. So, because it's a worldwide phenomenon, and I think everybody has the right to know this, So, I agreed to do it, and they came to me. They hired a local, I don't want to say where because I don't really make it public where I live, but they hired from a larger city around here, a local production company, and they came down and they had provided what questions that they wanted, and that was I was like, wow, how come if a major network in Russia can send somebody to film
Yes.
at my location, how come none of these companies in Los Angeles can,
That's right. They make us fly all over the place, all disheveled and jet lagged and
Yeah.
bleary-eyed. And
It was so much better. I was so fresh, because most of the television stuff I've done is exactly what you're talking about. You're so tired because of the travel, and there's no time to. And of course, you're under the pressure of these constant questions, See, I feel like in my case, and I don't know if you feel like this or not, but like you have a target on you, like they're just waiting for you to slip up just one time, so they can have some kind of crack to open the door, so they can come at you because they're going to come at you any way that they can, But it got to the point with me, and I'll just briefly touch on this. And this sealed it. I actually took the second book off the market, which is now abridged and part of the book I just put out with a whole lot of additional material. They pulled in my driveway, the black tinted window SUVs, and basically my life was threatened. And they visited twice, So, but I always thought that one of my protections was like John. I don't. You know who John Lear is?
Lear, the late John Lear.
John Lear, yeah, he's passed. Yeah. So he was a friend of mine in Vegas years ago. And actually remained that way till the end. And he told me, like, he was one of the first persons I ever told what was going on. I learned a lot from that guy. And he told me, like, look, if you ever go public, try to set yourself up to go as big as you can right away because that is your protection. I was lucky enough to do that because when that first book came out, it went big really quick and I got a lot of attention really quick and I felt kind of safe in that. And here's the thing, even now, like, even with these threats, it's like, first of all, I really feel it's very, very important at the stage we are now in humanity that this kind of stuff has to get out there. It has to get out there. We are slipping down the wrong way down the road, and we have to learn. It's like a tall gray once told me, we are all one with the one who is all. Like I asked him a question, who is your God? And that's exactly what he told me. We are all one with the one who is all. So if an alien being has that kind of sentiment, that level of consciousness, then we got a long ways to go, It's like, so we need to learn that. Like, and that's one of the things that I try to talk about also, it's like we have to evolve ourselves. And it's sort of a message that I'm trying to spread in bringing this stuff out, So I feel that kind of importance. But it's also like I'm kind of upset by that it got to that level with these guys. I knew they'd been doing all this other stuff with me over the years. Because I've always said, look, like I met him in Boulder City, Nevada too. They came in. I write about that. I write about it. I told the story again in this book, where two of them came in, and there was a store called Area 52 there, and it's all about aliens, and they came in, when I was there one time and cleaned everybody out, told the girl who was working at the cash register, go in the storeroom, they shut the door, and one stood guard and one talked to me. And they were nice. They were nice back then. They knew who I was, obviously, and I was kind of taken back at that time. But they told me the last thing they said was keep up the good work. You know, so I'm like, wow, man, you know, they made it a point to do this, you know, to go to that extreme to talk to me, obviously because they didn't want to scare me at the home front, you know, or something like that, you know, but they had to have been following me at the time to catch me going in there. But anyway, it went from that to what happened a few years ago here, you know. And I'm like, the only difference, there's more, way more to it. I've got more Hollywood stuff that got sequestered, and they shot me down in every which way they possibly could.
I can relate to some of that because that adds a whole nother layer of unreality to it. Because first of all, you're coming to grips with there's billions of people on this planet. What do these aliens have? What kind of interest do they have in me? Like, was it something I said? You know? And then when the deep black spook elements get involved, it's like then you see then you've it's a whole nother layer because you have all these emotions that come up, right? I felt the extreme sense of betrayal, as egotistical as that sounds, right? I was one of those flag rate waivers. I was, you know, my dad was a Vietnam vet. You know, we were always rooting for the Navy and the Army Navy game because my dad was, you know, Brownwater Navy in Nam, and you know, Roger Staubach came out of the Naval Academy. I was a big Cowboy fan, America's team, right? And then when all this stuff happens, and I worked in civil service for Naval Air Force's Pacific Fleet, right? So I didn't have to prove my loyalty or, you know, what a good person I was. So what's the problem with me just wanting to find out what the hell's going on with me and potentially countless others? And then when this whole other layer comes in to kind of stomp you down because, you know, apparently we're not allowed to delve into all this stuff, even though it directly involves us, that adds a whole nother level of betrayal, of anger, of resentment, of paranoia. You know, you probably went through
Exactly.
all the phone clicks. You probably went through all the phone
Oh yeah.
hangups. Oh, I
Oh
went
yeah.
through all that.
That happened back when I was talking to Lear. They were the phone. He found bugs. I found bugs. Just, you know, back in the old, you know, everybody had the old analog phones. But that is the thing that I exactly can relate to that as well, because it you do feel betrayed. I've always felt that I was helping these guys out. It's like, look, sooner or later, the truth's going to come out. You know, so the more people acceptance that you can get from the people, the easier it is for disclosure. You know, it's like we can talk about the UAPs all day long, but you know, it doesn't really. And I admire the people. You know, George Knapp was, you know, he's a friend of my brother and me, you know, I've been on the show and stuff, and I've known him for a long time. And I admire that he's like going to Congress, you know, a few months ago, and everybody that's doing it, you know, I'm behind you for that. But I just don't think it's going to happen in the way that some of these people think that it's going to happen, you know. But the more people that's on their end that's doing that kind of thing, explaining, you know, these military people that's whistleblowers are coming forward, and then the people like us that's coming forward. You know, I think it makes it all easier to accept for the general public, you know. So why they're trying to silence us is beyond me. To me,
Because
we're helping them.
when it comes right down to it, this is a human phenomena because it's happening to humans, right?
It's a humankind phenomenon, no doubt.
Because it would be disturbing enough, and which is already happening, it has been happening with, you know, the cattle mutes and, you know, the elk being taken up and even human mutilation. So just looking from an animal standpoint, that would be alarming enough as it is. Right, and they scoop all this water and fish out of the oceans and streams and drop it out of the skies on us when I guess they need to offload it or whatever. And you know, throughout history, we have all these weird fish falls and frog falls coming out of the sky. And so, you know, it's bad enough that it's happening to animals that don't really have a say in the matter, but when it happens to us and we make an issue out of it, suddenly we're in the crosshairs. Suddenly we're the bad guys, right? And again, it adds a whole nother layer of paranoia because they will strive to make you paranoid. And it reminds me of, the threats that you got and the threats that I had and others had in the past. And I don't really know the totality of Stan Romanek's story, right? But I know what they did to him was anyone can get into our computers and put anything into it and take things out of, right? And so what happened with him, if I follow the story correctly, because he had set cameras up and what have you, and actually filmed ETs, right? And remember, we're of an era. We're part of that transition team when we rub shoulders with the old school guys. Leo Sprinkle had investigated some of the biggest cases in UFO history,
Yeah,
and you work with him,
I love Leo.
and you work with all the other guys. So you're part of, like myself, you're kind of part of the old guard that's still around, right? And then we see this whole horde, thankfully, of all these people coming after us, and they've got all their shows and everything. But back then we had to do field investigations. We had to read tons of books. We had to like network and run up gigantic phone bills back in the day. So, point being is that we're doing all this just to allay our own fears, our own misgivings, develop a better understanding about this. Suddenly we come under the crosshairs and we start getting harassed, and that pissed me off no end, right? And I talked to others, Leah Haley, a number of the old timers back in the day, and it's like, of all the things that hurt the most, right, was the deep black government harassment was like rubbing salt in the wounds after all we'd been through. And the thing about it, as you know, Brett, some of these people that have gotten harassed, they haven't even talked about this stuff. They haven't gone out in the lecture circuit. They're not doing podcasts, and they're still getting harassed. A lot of it has to do with the level of credibility too. You come across because you are as an articulate, well-spoken, highly intelligent guy, and that really like sets off alarm bells, because as you mentioned earlier, this happens to everyone, from druggie down and outers. The people at the other end of the spectrum, all points in between. We talked about it. Some of us, Barbara Barthel, had a term for it. We self-medicate sometimes because the experiences are so hard to come to grips with. The ridicule factor, you can't bring it up with people. I went through it. It wasn't until I moved to San Diego that I could bring up this subject without getting laughed at by people I thought were friends and family, right? So.
That's why I went to such extremes to prove the reality. That's why I did all this stuff for the evidence to prove irrefutable that this stuff is real, because that it's out there, it's huge, and I went to that extreme. Now there's nothing, like I said, there's nothing else I can do.
Right, that's right.
Like there's nothing else. That's a pile of evidence like no case ever in history. And if that's not enough for you, then sorry,
Then it's
then
not for them, and it's time to move on. Or just, if those people just want to be bystanders, it's fine. But anyway, we've reached the end of a fascinating first segment with our guest, Brett Oldham. Brett, could you give our viewing and listening audience the means to contact you and find your book?
Well, it's
Books.
on Amazon, but I've got a website. Actually, I just did a new website, and it should be public. Just my name, brettoldham.com. I'm not sure when this is going to air, but in the next couple of days, my website will be published. So, there's more information there also.
We'll get this out within the next couple of weeks. And for our dear listeners out there, if you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, please go to thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up and become a member, and we'll see you at the top of the next segment.